This is the Amp Hour Podcast. Release February 27th, 2022. Episode 579. ADC Chip Design with Anthony Wall. Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Chris Gamble of Contextual Electronics.
And I'm Anthony Wall. I'm doing a PhD in mixed signal design, designing current mode circuits and current to digital converters for high precision applications.
Hi, Anthony. How are you?
I'm good. It's an honor to be on the show finally. I've been listening for years, and I suppose maybe one of the first generations of people who were listening to the show maybe before undergrad, and it kind of formed my undergrad experience and, you know, learning about electronics in a more casual way like this. And yeah, it's an honor to finally be on the show on the other side.
Well, that's great. I appreciate that. I appreciate you listening. Some of the words you said, obviously you have surpassed much of my knowledge already, given the words you said at the beginning of the show. What are you doing?
Yeah, apologies. Yeah, that's the pre-programmed.
No, this is good. Yeah. This is why you're here. We want the cool stuff. This is awesome.
Yeah, you know, you ask us, you know, a PhD student, like, well, you know, how are things getting on? Like, you know, and you just get the kind of, you know, I don't want to talk about it. So you give the complicated, quick answer, right? I apologize. I gave you that instinctually. So
No, that's good.
I'll break
it's down. It's the stop asking me questions answer, you know? It's like, oh, I work on very complicated things. And unless you want to be here for a while, but we do want to be here for a while. So yeah, let's hear the other one.
Right. Well, yeah, right. We have an hour. So, you know, everything around us is analog, and it's obvious at this point we need to sometimes convert these analog signals, whatever they may be, to digital. And I focus primarily on taking currents and converting them to digital, hopefully as efficient a way as possible in terms of doing it power efficiently and area efficiently on chip. So yeah, effectively using ring oscillators to do so. And I'd be, yeah, we can chat about more about how I do that.
Sure. And so where are you doing this PhD?
Yes, apologies. Yeah, I'm in Ireland. So I'm not sure if your podcast player has a half speed option. So if I'm talking too quickly, you know, feel free to use that. I'm in Ireland. I'm in Cork, in the Tyndall National Institute. It's a kind of an Irish government run and funded institute, which focuses on everything between atoms and systems. So from like kind of research in kind of both silicon and exotic material devices, like the next generation of transistors, all the way up to, embedded systems devices and their applications.
Oh, cool. So it's like a base science. It's like the Bell Labs of the Irish government.
Yeah, that's a compliment. Yeah, we'll take that. Okay. Yeah, but effectively, yes, that's the idea. And, you know, you want as much cross collaboration as possible between the different groups. And that's the kind of idea. If we're all in the same house together, hopefully we'll talk to each other and come up with some good ideas. And I suppose I'm situated right in the middle of that. I design circuits using devices that someone has already, you know, created, you know, well-established technologies. And hopefully someone will then further use the chips I make in kind of systems level stuff. So we're sitting right in the middle.
Yeah, that's awesome. And so interesting. So it's like a national university, undergrad all the way up through grad programs like you're in?
No, actually. So it's strongly, so it's associated with all the universities in Ireland are public.
Yep.
And it's strongly associated with University College Cork, which is right next door. But it's affiliated with all of the universities in Ireland. So I did my undergrad in University College Cork, and then I was whisked straight across the road into Tyndall to be told go away for a few years and create some circuits. So I did my postgrad in Tyndall, or I'm doing it.
That's great. No, that's really cool. And so we were talking a little bit about before the show, just about, like, obviously we've been talking about Intel and all the fabs that are happening in the US right now, driven by a lot of like tax policy and just wanting to reshore some of the semiconductor stuff. But Ireland has a ton of semiconductor stuff. Notably, Analog Devices is really big there. Intel has a big fab there. Why Ireland?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I'm not sure of the like the specific numbers on it, but it certainly feels like the highest proportion of semi companies to people in the world, area wise, outside of Silicon Valley, of course.
Yeah.
It's an interesting story. I could kind of trace it back to the 1930s. So when aviation started becoming really, really popular, the first transatlantic flights started happening, but flights couldn't go from like London or Paris to New York on a single tank of fuel. So they'd have to make some refueling stops.
Yeah, I always think of the map view in Indiana Jones where they show all the different, it's like, why are they doing all these little hops to islands or whatever? It's like, oh yeah, those planes, they were not fun.
Right.
A lot of scotch drinking on those flights, I think.
And thankfully we were one of those stops, right? You know, there's a convenient little island between London and New York. I think I can't remember exactly what the range on these flights were, but it was just slightly too far away for London, but Ireland was right in the sweet spot. So,
oh, interesting. Yeah, I always seen like they go up to like Newfoundland. Like if you're going from New York, you'd like go up to Newfoundland and then maybe over to Iceland, like Reykjavik, and then maybe down to Ireland and then over to the UK,
exactly,
or over to England.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they were actually the hops that were used. So the Irish government with the British government and the US, they all came to this agreement that they'd build this airport in the middle of nowhere in the west of Ireland. And, if anyone's familiar with Ireland, that's a really kind of barren place. Like the population density is so low.
Was it just like farmers and the cliffs or what?
Actually, yeah. Farmers and cliffs. That's, really beautiful part of the world.
Yeah, totally.
Incredibly beautiful. But yeah, very, 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 very sparse. So it was actually, this town of Shannon built up around this airport. And it was the first town built in Ireland, like the first new town in Ireland in like 300 years. So it was like, this big thing. And this was kind of the 1930s. So people would stop in Shannon and, they'd be there for a couple hours while the plane is being refueled and whatever else. And off they'd go again. So the only experience people would have with Ireland would be the meal that they'd have while they're here. So, this fella, this hotelier by the name of O'Regan, he got the idea that, at the time, I think it was British Airways were supplying the food and stuff at Shannon, and Ireland, having gained independence only 10 years previous, obviously didn't want, the only experience people have with Ireland be a British one. So they said, right, this O'Regan fella says, I'll start my own little restaurant in Shannon Airport and people can have Irish food. But this guy had, I think he trained in Paris. He had an eye for detail. And one day someone was bringing out a cup of coffee for someone. And, he says, this looks very plain. So your man goes away and puts cream on top and whiskey in it. And that was the story of the Irish coffee, right?
Uh-huh, that's Our listeners may be familiar with the finer point.
Yeah, actually. Yeah, yeah. No. I had actually never had an Irish coffee until my American girlfriend came over and says, oh, you've never had an Irish coffee and you're Irish. Like, anyway, So this guy really, people were raving about this restaurant, long story short. And, the Irish government gave this O'Regan guy a big pat in the back. So he kind of gets this mad idea, right? How can we hold people in Ireland a little bit longer? And he invents the idea of like a duty free shop where people don't have to pay tax. And, they sold lots of Irish goods. And that was kind of where duty free came from. So then he said, right, let's build a fence around the airport. And instead of having one duty free shop, maybe we can have like many duty free businesses. And his idea, he kind of put it to the Irish government, right, anyone inside this area, as long as they can fly in their raw materials and fly out their processed product, as long as they can do that, they don't have to pay any tax to the Irish government. The idea was that they, create jobs and stuff like that. So you can imagine, right, that benefits certain industries.
Right. Well, this is starting to already sound similar to some of the tax incentives driving just chip design generally these days. So,
yes.
So fast forward a little bit here. So basically, I'm guessing the yada, yada, yada is chip companies did that?
Yep, exactly. Yeah. So ADI came along and they built a fab here for that exact reason. It's easy to fly in wafers and easy to fly out chips, right? So And it worked really well. It created some high quality, well paid jobs. And at the time, Ireland was a very poor country. So that was a big boon for the economy in the area. You know, happy days.
Yeah.
And you know, once one comes, the rest follow. We're also really, really lucky. So the story of Intel and LeakSlip is, you know, similar. It's like, I mean, ADI are here. There are people kind of coming along. They're more graduates, da, da, da. And also the other big benefit for us is a rock. We're in a limestone region. So like, you know, the rock is really porous and it kind of absorbs vibration. So there's very little seismic activity here. So if you're building a fab, right, if you're trying to build a fab and you have these little shakes and you're trying to align your lithography machinery, it's not going to go so well, I assume. Not my area of expertise.
You know, and that's always interesting because I've heard that, you know, obviously they talked about that when I was at Samsung and I get that. But then I'm like, but what the hell is Japan doing? Like, fabs for years. I mean, right, not as many like newer fabs, but still like a lot. And I think Taiwan has some activity too. So they must just have them on shaker tables or something like that, or anti-shaker tables.
I assume so. Or, you know, maybe I don't know if it's a yield thing or if it's if the ground is shaking, stop making chips. I'm not too sure. I assume it could be a yield thing.
The ground shakes. You're like, I guess we're throwing this batch out. As long as you detect it fast enough.
Right. Yeah, still. Exactly.
Yeah.
So that they're the two main things that kind of attracted the first two were kind of Intel and Qualcomm, Intel and ADI. And, you know, now we have, you know, the who's who of semiconductors. We've got, you know, Onsemi and Xilinx and Qualcomm and uBlocks and whoever else, you know. Once one comes, they all come.
Yeah. And that's the effect that we were kind of talking about too, of like, you have this talent pool now, and then it's like, all right, well, now we want to hire people, and it's such a specialized talent that, you know, a Qualcomm comes in and says, oh, well, we could hire a bunch of, we could, you know, quote unquote, set up an office in Limerick and hire, you know, four designers. Maybe it's only four designers to start, but then that's like a toehold. And then it becomes 10, 50, 100, whatever. And then it just becomes this bigger and bigger thing. And there's such knowledge around it. So,
yeah. And it's, as you said, you know, the tax incentives, the Irish government at some point obviously went, oh, you know, these semiconductors, they might like catch on or something, you know, let's give some tax incentives. And also I think the universities were quite smart in terms of like, you know, all the analog stuff seems to be down in Cork. So let's teach all the Cork students analog stuff.
Well, that's what I was wondering then. So then Shannon is pretty far north of, and Limerick are pretty far north of Cork. So how do those get connected then?
Well, I suppose
maybe my map skills are off. I don't know.
No, you're right. You're right. It's kind of, there's a kind of a sense of like, you know, Dublin and not Dublin. So I always think of people in Dublin, they do digital stuff. I don't know what they're at all. And down in the country, we're kind of a bit rougher. Like we like the analog stuff. It's a bit messier, you know?
So it's the real world.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know.
After this, we're going out for a hike.
Exactly. I'll be killed for saying that, but anyway,
But even the fact that Dublin then does have, you know, so just now the whole country, you know, you've stated now three different regions of the country, pretty much, you know, west, east, and south. I'm not sure about the north, but like, okay, so now you have three different areas of doing chip design. That's pretty significant, you know. It's that's not small for a pretty small country. So
yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there are very few places, you know, I'm faced with the fact, you know, I've done my undergrad in Cork. I've done my postgrad, hopefully now soon in Cork. You know, I would like to see the world. There's the urge to go to Silicon Valley, but it's a hard sell to get me to go anywhere else because you can have a job in Ireland. You know, there's a list of companies that are looking for people here. So, yeah, we're very lucky.
And you can't beat the weather either, you know. Sorry, I muted myself and I made that joke and I was like, oh, that didn't land.
No,
Irish weather is like so similar to like Cleveland and Chicago that I feel like I'm allowed to make that joke in the old days, you know.
So. No, you are, yeah. I've only ever been to Chicago once. It's feckin' windy. Very windy. Yeah. I suppose, yeah, they call it the Windy City, right?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, and so you might travel after PhD is done, stuff like that. I mean, what is the recruiting like out of like Tyndall or more broadly just in Irish upper universities.
It's, yeah, I mean, I think we have a similar problem here that you guys have. Like, it's hard to get engineers. Companies can't fill positions. And out of Tyndall, you know, a lot of our projects are part funded privately. So you'll have your sponsoring company may offer you a position, and, you know,
got it.
If they don't, you walk outside the door and turn left, and there's the other fella, you know. So
yeah,
you know, it unfortunately microelectronics isn't cool, as cool as it was. I mean, I think it's really cool, but it's not AI, so it's harder to get people in the door.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just feel like it'd be so specialized these days too. Like, I mean, there's so many programs. I mean, obviously there's a lot of AI type of roles that are popping up and stuff like that, but there's got to be just such specialized knowledge. I have to imagine that eventually these chip companies are going to be like, oh, I guess we got a upper salary, you know, just like the usual supply and demand type of stuff.
It is. I think that what I've seen in the last couple of years is that the chip design companies have kind of said like, oh, you know, all of our graduate students want to do AI. So, you know, for example, Qualcomm and Cork have brought about this mixed signal AI group. And, you know, that's kind of exciting for young engineers. So there's kind of, you know, you can pay people more, or you can let them do the jobs they want to do. And I think there's, you know, there's a confluence somewhere in the middle.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. I mean, chips for us, please.
Yeah. Just please give it. Yeah. Oh yeah. We'll design you chips. Like, you're not going to get chips in the next 2 years, but there's people designing them, right?
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Okay. So you're at Tyndall, you're making these chips. What drives then your research? So you're working on these, you know, they're called starved current ring oscillators, right?
Right. Current starved ring oscillators. Yeah, sure.
Current starved ring oscillators. Yeah. So that's someone who needed that specifically. And then they kind of like put out a call for proposals for that sort of thing. Or is it like, you're just because of the PI that you're working with is already has this research and needs to take it forward? What drove you towards that space?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And you've kind of touched on our dirty little secret in the ADC research world, I suppose. It's great to have an application, like a killer application, that your chip is the only chip that will work for this particular thing. Unfortunately, that's tougher and tougher to do. Research is so mature at this point that most things have been done in terms of, you know, so a lot of it comes down to like, oh, you know, I can do this conversion for X number of picojoules, or, you know, I can do this conversion
faster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it becomes a race to the bottom in terms of just, you know, figures of merit and performance. Hmm. So I was lucky enough that there was a company that wanted to hire me. And I said, for some reason, I wanted to research more. So they said, look, you know, go away for 4 years, do something fun. We'll pay for you. And if the research is valuable, great. As I was growing up, I was always really curious about, you know, how capacitors worked. I never understood how capacitors worked. So I now have ring oscillators with capacitors in them, and I love playing with them all day. And that's effectively why I'm doing what I do.
Nice. That's great. So do we need to then maybe talk about how ADCs work? Would that be helpful for this conversation, or are we kind of just kind of hand wave past it?
Yeah, no, I think it might be interesting to kind of just understand why we need, you know, well, right, why do we need ADCs? Maybe that's clear. Why do we need current ADCs, and why do we need to keep researching them? That's maybe a more interesting question, right?
Yeah. And what is the actual application of, sorry, what is the usual target application for current ADCs?
So there are more and more applications for them recently. For example, like a lot of electrochemical sensors. So you have some sensor, and whether it's pressure, whether it's giving you an out, so you have a sensor sensing something, and whether it gives you a pressure or a flow proportional to what you're measuring dictates whether it's a current or a voltage ADC that you need, right? So, you know, if your signal is, for example, a microphone, that might be a capacitance, so you might get a voltage out. Whereas if you have an electrochemical sensor, you might have some kind of ionic current you're trying to sense. That is a current. And you want to use the type of ADC that your signal is proportional to. Like a photodiode gives you a current proportional to your light. So mm-hmm. if you were to use a voltage ADC, you'd either have to do some conversions or deal with horrendous nonlinearity, you know.
Right. Or have a really expensive resistor. That is a current to voltage converter, right?
Right. Yeah. I make really expensive resistors. Yeah.
So obviously Keithley, that was my jam at Keithley a little bit when I was doing stuff that was, you know, a lot of what the measurement equipment is, you know, you're measuring current and it's just going into a feedback circuit is going through a fancy resistor, right? It's that same kind of, you're doing yes. a current balance with a fancy resistor in between the two. And so it's like, right. okay, well, that right. resistor yeah. is part of that conversion matrix, I think.
Exactly, right? So okay, so why don't we take that as the basis? Like, okay, you can now measure currents, right? You put it into a TIA, a transimpedance amplifier. You know, mm-hmm. that sounds fancy, but it's effectively an op amp with a resistor in its feedback path, right?
Yep.
And the idea is you feed your current into that, and the current develops a voltage across the resistor, and that's your output voltage.
Yeah, and actually, so if people think about like a photodiode conversion circuit, that's often what that is, right? I mean, it's you have a photodiode on the left side of the op amp, you know, left or right saying here, and then on yep. the right side, you got the output of the op amp, and in between, you got that fancy 1 mega ohm resistor.
Exactly, right? So if, and you know, you have a voltage out then, and you can put that into your ADC chip, right? Your typically ADC chips will measure a voltage and give you a digital code out, and you know, happy days, that's job done. The question then is, right, okay, I now have an op amp on my board with a resistor in the feedback path, and I have an ADC chip. What if I want to put that all on one monolithic chip, you know, one chip, integrate it all? It becomes a lot more difficult because firstly, you know, you might get a nice op amp based on some old BJT technology that'll give you plus minus 15 volt rails.
Yeah. Yep.
Right. That'd yep, be lovely, yep. but
make sure that's nice and linear too, you know, and really low noise. And
right. Yeah. Yeah. Like no matter how much money, you know, you can pay loads of money for that chip and get it, but like no matter how much money you have, you can't put that on your own chip. For example, right. I designed a chip on 65 nanometer, and that'll give you a 1.2 volt supply rail in the core of the chip. So,
yeah,
you know,
pretty much the same as plus minus 15.
Yeah, yeah, like do whatever you want as long as it's, you know, between 0 and 1.2 volts, which is
right.
That's only so many VGSs of transistors. That's right. So that's problem number one. That's why it's tough to build a TIA, a transimpedance amplifier on a chip. The second thing is, right, you have this resistor in a feedback loop. Like, how do you make a resistor on a chip? Well, you must have this resistive material and you need to snake it along, make a long path of resistive material. Right. You know, if you're trying to measure a small current, you need a large resistor to develop a large mm-hmm. voltage across it. So then your resistor just becomes huge. It's this big, long snake. And you're paying for a chip. And yeah. most of your chip is resistor. Like, I mean, it, you then literally have the most expensive resistor in the world, you know?
Right. I just imagine your graduate thesis being like, well, it works, but we only get one chip per wafer. 100% yield.
Yeah. I drew the snake in Microsoft Paint and there we go. Exported the GDS files off to the fab and happy days.
Perfect. Yeah. That sounds about, I might be able to do that. Like if I went and took like Matt Venn's course and like how to use GDS and stuff like that, and maybe yes. I could maybe get to that point, but that's about it.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, you could make quite a neat, say you know how to make a differential pair and you might, you know how to make an output stage of an op amp, right? So say you can make a traditional op amp, you can make a TIA, you make a big resistor, you can make a TIA.
Yeah.
But then that's the question of why are we still researching these things if we know how to make them? You know, we want to make them small.
Well, and I think it sounds like some of this is logistical cost, all of that kind of stuff. But then I think about I think about a lot of the analog circuits I've worked on in the past too, and they're always plugged into the wall, and they're already at a, you know, 30C ambient, whatever the warm-up time is. And it's just like, okay, well, that doesn't work great when you're trying to measure something in the field or you're battery powered or whatever. So there's then that whole power consideration thing that I'm sure is part of your work as well.
Exactly. Like, you know, the guy who sits beside me, he's kind of more on the systems level, and he goes out to fields every day, and he checks for diseases in potatoes and cows using electrochemical sensors. You know, there aren't too many outlets in the fields of Ireland, so you need the battery to last, right?
You either got to do that or build your own methane to electricity converter.
Actually, yeah, <There's>, right?
You know, you got to strap it on the cow face and then you have a portable generator.
Exactly, yeah, ubiquitous free energy right there, yeah.
Because remember, folks, it's not cow farts that are the problem, it's cow burps. That is the source of greenhouse emissions.
Exactly. So, yeah, I think we've just solved the climate crisis.
Yeah.
Yeah. So okay. So it's clear, look, right, that these, you know, it's hard to make a TIA on a chip. So what are your options, right? So you say, right, well, my available voltage swing has shrunk, right? So the available voltage across that resistor has shrunk. So you can kind of make a hand wavy argument to say, like, if you can't have as much voltage, you can't have as much signal, which affects your signal to noise ratio. So it's harder to make good quality analog circuits on a chip. Yeah. And the ones you do make are expensive because you have these big long resistors. So
does this mean you also have, I mean, so you're mentioning less voltage overhead as well. I mean, so I think about a lot of the op amps I've used in the past, and they have, you know, like a protection diodes that are like just the standard 0.7 volt drop, you know, up to the rail. And so do you actually have those or no? Do you have to go protectionless?
No. You can use, so the chip will have kind of a core region and its IO region. You can use the whole rail in the core. So you can use 0 to 1.2 volts. You have protection diodes, but, you know, they will allow you to go to the rail, right?
Okay.
Yeah. So, you can use the 1.2 volts, but the question is kind of, right, what direction are chips going, you know? The voltages are shrinking, but what's maybe getting better? And you say, right, well, transistors are getting faster. And what does faster mean? Well, it means the parasitics are getting lower. So the capacitances of each transistor are getting lower. So that kind of begs the natural argument that, okay, rather than representing our signals in the voltage domain, i.e. turning a current into a voltage and then digitizing it, could we maybe turn a current into this kind of time domain thing, a time domain representation, and then digitize that? So, you know, you imagine, right, you feed a current into a TIA and it will give you a voltage out. Well, why not feed a current into a ring oscillator and that will give you a frequency out, right? So if chips are getting better at generating frequencies with more precision because the capacitances and the parasitics are getting lower, maybe we should go that direction. And that's the core idea behind using, say, like ring oscillators for current measurement.
Okay. And so then can you give us a quick refresher? I'm going to just say it. Can you give me a quick refresher on how a ring oscillator works?
Right. I mean, you say give you a quick refresher. Honestly, sometimes I need a quick refresher. They're very unintuitive things.
Yeah. I remember there's like a feedback path that's like, wait, why would you hook that there? I remember that with oscillators, but that's about it.
Yeah. And I mean, depending who you'll talk to, different people will have different explanations and definitions. Like you'll talk to an RF guy and, you know, they'll start telling you about Barkhausen criterions and 180 degree phase inversions. You talk to a digital person and they go, that shouldn't go there. And, you know, I'm somewhere in the middle between those two, I suppose.
Got it. Yeah.
So the way I like to think about it is, if you simplify it right down and you imagine, say, like a current source charging a capacitor, and that's analogous to, like a tap feeding water into a bucket, right? And how do you know how much water is flowing into that bucket? Well, one way of doing it is measuring how many times that bucket fills up in a given amount of time, right? So if you look at the bucket for a minute and you're filling it with water and you have to empty it three times, well, you know, you have about, you know, three buckets worth of water per minute is coming out of that tap.
Yep.
So effectively a ring oscillator kind of automates that idea. So if you think now, you rather than you having to pick up the bucket and throw out the water, what if I were to put a ball cock on the top? So it basically detects when the water level reaches a certain level, right? So I'm pouring the water in, and when the water level reaches, this ball cock triggers and it dumps the water out of the bottom of the bucket, right? So you've got a ball cock and you've got a valve that kind of releases all of the water. So now you can kind of, you can measure how many times that ball cock triggers per minute. And that's the same thing, right? It's just automated. You can do that many, many, many times. The smaller your bucket, the more accurate you are in a given time period. So that's the fundamental idea, right? That's what you call a relaxation oscillator in the technical terminology, right? You replace the water tap with a current source that you're trying to measure, and you replace the bucket with a capacitor. So you're filling the capacitor with charge, and you dump that charge when it fills up, and you measure how many charge dumps happen per given time period, right?
Yep.
So that's a relaxation oscillator. And then if you want to think about what a ring oscillator is, like if you look at the schematic for a ring oscillator, it looks like three inverters all connected in a loop together.
Yeah, that's the one I've, yeah, that's like Jim Williams' schematics always had those in there.
Right, exactly, right? So how do I equate that to what I've just described in terms of the water bucket? Well, if you think the VDD of those inverters, right, the power supply of those inverters, if you think of connecting a current source to all of those in parallel, right, then you've got three inverters that kind of have this capacitance inherently at their output. You can see that the current will be steered into the capacitance at the inverters. So effectively what that looks like is these three stages of the ring oscillator in series. Of the relaxation oscillator in series. So you've got, you know, one bucket filling, and then it'll pass to the next stage, and the next bucket will fill. And then when that bucket fills, it'll pass to the third element in the ring oscillator, and that bucket will fill. And once that bucket fills, it goes right back to the start. And you've got this effectively, you know, instead of the bucket resetting itself, the bucket actually resets the next one in the chain, and the next one, and the next one.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. It's a weird concept to describe without showing it physically.
I mean, yeah, no, it definitely is a weird concept. I mean, like how much control then do you have? So like, is it just like a characteristic frequency then based on that or something else?
Yeah, that's a good question. And that's kind of what makes these things kind of tough. So you've got three inverters, and you imagine, right, what's the analogy of this ball cock, right? What's detecting the water level or the charge level? Well, that's the voltage, right? That's the voltage that the cap charges to. Well, what detects that is actually the threshold of the next inverter. So once you reach the threshold of the next inverter in the chain, it starts a charge dump.
Right, because the logic levels, you're saying, right? That's the logic level threshold.
Okay. Yes. Now, the problem is that inverter, I mentioned that the VDD of that inverter is connected to the tap, right? It's connected to the current source. So, you know, the voltage on that node is going to change. So the VDD of the inverter is going to change, meaning the threshold of that inverter is going to change, right? So the very act of putting current into this system changes the level that the ball cock triggers on. So you've got this nonlinearity inherent in the system. Also, right, I'm telling you that you measure how many times the water dumps per second, for example. That's assuming that all the time is spent filling the bucket, but there's also some time spent emptying the bucket. And if the time spent emptying the bucket is significant, you know, your frequency is kind of, you know, it's not only dependent on the filling, it's also dependent on the emptying. So your frequency slows down a little bit, and you've got this kind of complex interplay between the amount of current you have flowing in and the VDDs and the empty time. So yeah, it's...
But that's interesting too, because then that starts to sound like a sawtooth wave, which is like the basis of a dual slope oscillator, dual slope ADC as well. And so that starts to make my mind think like, oh, okay, I could see how this might start to play towards an ADC application.
Right. Yeah, and exactly. Like, I mean, a slope ADC is a very, very similar concept. You can make the relaxation oscillator analogy and the water bucket analogy about a slope ADC also in a slightly different way, but you can make the same analogy. So you can imagine, right, ideally you want a sawtooth out of this. And, you know, effectively what I'm trying to do in my research is make it look as much like a sawtooth as possible.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So if you simulate one of these things, you'll see it roughly looks sawtooth-ish, but the final value of the sawtooth is poorly defined. And the, you know, it's not a bang straight down after the end of the ramp. It's kind of a gentle slope down. So you want, I'm trying to make the final point of the sawtooth well-defined, and I'm trying to make the bang straight down so that there's no time wasted in the discharge.
Yeah, and I can imagine that you could maybe, you know, try and cheat a little bit and like have like a really low impedance path out of there to try and dump current out. But I would imagine that the frequency that you're ultimately like getting in or out of there would also then end up impacting how fast it wants to empty anyways.
Exactly. And so, yeah.
You must be chasing your tail quite often on this stuff, huh?
Yeah, it's a fun one, right? Because, you know, with an op amp, for example, the tools are, you know, you look at for LTSpice, right? It's really easy to do like a .AC sim on an LTSpice and look at your amplifier and say you're doing an op amp, a traditional TIA, say. It's really easy to do an AI. Oh yeah, this is how this thing works. There's a frequency response. You know, I can do a DC sweep and I can see where the TIA works, and then I can do a transient, da da da. With this, it's kind of like, what does it mean to look at the frequency response of a ring oscillator? It's a, you know, it's this kind of, it's not a stationary circuit. It's always kind of rolling over. So just even from the tools point of view, it's kind of hard to see where these non-linearities are coming from. It's hard to see where these non-idealities stem from, if that makes sense.
I could see that. I mean, how do you then start to chase those down? I mean, so I imagine that the impact is still the same. You still are like, oh well, this needs to have some kind of predictability. So then is it like, do you have things that you can go after? And
right,
what tools do you have at your disposal then? Like, you know, so you're designing this actually on silicon, so you might have some more capabilities in there, but is it just like patching with different tricks or process differences? I don't know what tools you have available to you.
Right. So I've kind of modified the ring oscillator slightly. So I've done some architectural stuff, and then obviously there's the whole, you know, all of the tweaking that needs to happen. On the architecture level, I've made basically a good valve, right? So I can ensure that the dump happens really quickly and the dump is independent of how much current is coming in. So I know, right? So I know that my dump right now takes 70 picoseconds. I can guarantee you that. If I know that, I can also quantify the nonlinearity that generates, if that makes sense. So my frequency is a product of the charge time, but also this 70 picoseconds that we don't want. But I know it's there, so I can subtract it maybe digitally afterwards, for example.
And when you say 70 picoseconds, that is a limit or that is a precision? Like that's a guarantee that it's always 70 picoseconds?
That is 70 picoseconds on a nominal chip, right? So
okay, all right.
In the research world, like, you know, when you make things and you have to like make money and deal with like shareholders and all that crack, your chips have to work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Idiots.
For us, you know, if our chip works on a sunny day in the lab, fantastic. You know, it happened. Yeah, it has to work.
This is going on a poster.
Yeah, exactly. Just like nobody breathe. Let me just like write my paper here and now, get these results and put them into the conference.
I gotta get out of here.
You know, just turn off all the lights in the lab. Make sure
I'm so sick of eating ramen.
Yeah. So long and short, right? That 70 picoseconds that I'm mentioning, that is the time. So I have this switch that dumps out the charge, right? In reality, that's a transistor. So I know that if I give the gate of the transistor that a good blast, I know it'll take 70 picoseconds roughly for that charge to dissipate. Now, will it take 70 picoseconds at, you know, minus 30 degrees Celsius or plus 100 degrees Celsius? No, right? So that's some kind of future work I'll have to work on to try and, you know,
You characterize it, you account for that sort of thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. But I know it's roughly 70 picoseconds, right? So if I can subtract off that, I'm doing well. So our first test chip was to kind of try and prove this model, to prove that if I have this linear charging slope, and I know if I've constrained the maximum, kind of the maximum threshold, I suppose, and I've constrained the discharge time. If I've constrained those two things, does my model fit? I know what the non-idealities should be. And by the way, I'm talking about non-linearities and non-idealities. What this means is the more the threshold shifts and the more the discharge, the longer the discharge time, that means my transfer function is non-linear, meaning the amount of current is no longer exactly proportional to the frequency. It's slightly less. The frequency is slightly kind of lagging the input current. Yeah. And why I care about that is if you feed a sine wave into this thing, you'll see harmonics pop up because you don't have y equals mx plus c slope anymore. You have some, x squared terms and x cubed terms. So when you do the maths, you'll see, you'll see harmonics at multiples of the input frequency. So we don't want that.
Got it. And just to level set a little here. So the end application is just in broad buckets is slow or fast?
So this will measure kind of, nanoamp level currents at kind of megahertz bandwidths.
Okay. So pretty fast. Yeah. So not like a delta 24-bit delta sigma of slow, averaging over 45 days or whatever some of the no. ADCs want to do these days.
No, it's definitely not that. It's kind of, it's mid precision. It's kind of 8-bit precision right now. We hope that, so we've proven the model with this chip and it's getting 8-bit precision, but once we add the correction for it, we hope we could add 2 bits and remove a lot of the power consumption from it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what's it useful for? I don't know. And if any listeners need a 1 megahertz nanoamp level.
This is actually the reason Anthony is on the show right now. He's actually shopping this around.
Yeah, exactly. Like, please.
It's like going to Broadway and being like, hey, I got the script. I just need some dancers and a stage.
Yeah. No, I'm one step away. Like every Thursday we go to a farmer's market to get lunch. And like, I'm one step away from setting up a stall and selling that chip there. Cause I need someone to use this thing,
Get your fresh chip designs here.
Yeah, and I mean, look, I've got 100 of these things. I don't know how many people in the world can say they have 100 chips right now. So
exactly. Yeah,
get on to me.
Yeah,
and actually, exactly. So we did our test chip. We taped it out last April, and we were hit fairly severely with this whole thing as well. Yeah, I can actually talk you through how we get chips in our world.
Yeah, that'd be great. That'd be great.
Or don't get them in this case. So the way it works is effectively, I design my chip in for example, in the Cadence. We use the Cadence tool. So I effectively end up with a set of GDS files, which is not too dissimilar, broadly speaking, to Gerber files in the PCB world.
Yeah. Yep.
And I need to send those away. And effectively, the way it works is if I was to buy, if our group were to buy a whole mask set for an ADC for a whole wafer, it would cost at 65 nanometer a couple hundred grand. So that's not going to happen. So you have these companies that offer what are called MPWs or multi-project wafers. So a bunch of research groups will get together a couple of times per year and say, we commit to buy 4x4 millimeters on your silicon. We buy this space on the wafer and we'll get 100 chips back and we'll share that wafer with every other research group around Europe. So this company in Europe is called Europractice. I think there's a similar thing in the US called Moses.
Yep, that's right.
So they then farm that out to the fabs and say, oh look, we'll put a mask set together for this. We'll share the however many hundred grand of tooling costs for that particular mask set, and we'll send the design off to TSMC, and they'll give us back X number of wafers. Hmm. So that's what we did, right? So the standard MPW is 4 millimeters by 4 millimeters, and we don't even need that. I only needed 1 millimeter by 1 millimeter. So a couple times per year, they'll offer a special setup where they subdivide the MPW again, and they offer you a square millimeter. So that's what we got, and it's actually it's almost affordable. It's $3,500.
That gets you more chips then, like more for a single share, like a single share of the MPW?
It doesn't get you more chips, but it gets you the same number of chips at a much cheaper price. So I got 100 parts and it cost the research group, it didn't cost me, it cost about $3,500 to the university. If you were to do it as an individual, I think it's a bit more expensive. It's maybe $4,000 to $5,000. But it's in the realm of, you know, if you're trying to do a startup and have a prototype, it's in the realms of possibility.
I mean, $50 a chip these days, that's standard fare, right?
Yeah,
I mean, given
right.
The shortages.
Yeah.
So I'll build my own STM32, damn it.
Damn right. Yeah, just, you know, buy an ARM license and go hell for leather, right?
Yeah, right.
So yeah, we came up with the same kind of issues in terms of sourcing chips from our end. We send away our files to Europractice and they make the masks and they send it off to TSMC. And, you know, TSMC disappear for a few months and we're given a date in August. We tape out in April and we're given a date in August. You'll have your chips in your hand by then. You know, August rolls around and TSMC say, oh, you know, we'll have them to you in a month. And, you know, September rolls around. Oh, yeah, we'll have them to you in a month. And, you know, in the end, like, you're kind of just like, do my chips exist? Last year just, like, you know, having the crack and making some nice abstract art, you know?
Oh yeah, do you print that out? Do you actually hang it on the wall? I would imagine that would be, I guess it depends on which layer you want to print out, but
I have it as my desktop on my laptop. I'm trying to figure it out.
Can you send it to me so I can pretend I design one too?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. It's okay, cool. It's about a 20 megabyte image. I've kind of like got it.
Chop it up a little bit.
I assume it must be, you know, breaching some NDAs. Like, now, if you look at my screen, you're now breaching an NDA, I'm sure.
But, right. Yeah. All you have to do is memorize it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, just gobble it up really quick.
Right. Oh, yeah. I forgot.
Yeah. So long story short, we got our chips back kind of mid-October, November, when we should have got them in August. And I mean that, you know.
Oh, come on, man. Yeah,
not too bad in terms of the lead times. You know, you're talking about when you go on DigiKey, but sure. You know, when you're aiming for conferences and stuff, it's
yeah.
It's
I was going to say, if you're trying to graduate, that might put a kink in the hose. You know,
right? Yeah, exactly. So when you get some, you know, tiny little pieces of silicon back, you need to be able to use them. So you need to put them in a package. So Europractice will also offer you some packages. So you tell them how to bond the package out, what pins you want to go, you know, what pads on the chip you want to go to what pins, and they'll package that up. And yeah, you design a test PCB and hopefully everything turns on. It's interesting, actually.
Wait, don't leave us hanging. Did it?
Yes.
Yes.
somehow it didn't, you know, the fear of, like, the first time you power it on, you're slowly ramping up the current limit on the power supply and the sweat is dripping.
I can't even imagine. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it worked somehow. Somehow it worked. Yeah. Yeah. I was, incredibly lucky to say the least.
Surely, I mean, does your boss, your PI, whoever it is, do they sit you down and they're like, let me tell you a story about a time when the person's chip didn't work? I mean, like, you must get, like, stories like that, right? I mean, what happens?
Yeah, I mean, I'm lucky that, you know, the environment in Tyndall is very kind of, it's a friendly research environment. It's a positive environment. So, you know, they're not like, you know, you're fired if this doesn't work. But there is the stories. Like, I mean, you know, it doesn't turn on. Like, the worst case scenario is your chip comes back and you power it on and it's up in a puff of smoke. You have no way of knowing what's wrong with that. Like, you can go back on simulations and you may find kind of hints, but if your chip goes up in a puff of smoke as soon as you turn it on, like, there's no troubleshooting there, really. You know, it's another 6 months of your life. You go back and you figure it out. You try again.
99 more chips on the bench. 99 more chips on the bench.
Yep.
Oh, boy.
I was very lucky. I only popped a few of them, and you know, I gave them a happy burial, and you know, we got very, very lucky.
I mean, really, a chip going puff is kind of its own Viking funeral, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, it's going down valley. But, you know, the tools these days, and that was another thing I'd mentioned to you. You know, you've spent a lot of your time on the PCB side of things, and I've spent most of my time on the IC side of things. And, you know, I needed to design a test board to test this thing. So I made that kind of reverse transition from IC back to PCB. I had never done a PCB before this. So it was kind of an interesting, like,
harsh introduction.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very much so. you know, like 20 years ago, realistically 30 or 40 years ago now, chips were made, you know, chips were laid out using layout tape on these big boards. And, you know, tape out literally meant, you know, the layout tape is going out to the fab, right?
Right.
But nowadays, it's really difficult in the IC world to make a critical mistake. You can make functional mistakes and you can make, you know, your architecture, your bare idea may be flawed, but like it's difficult to have a short circuit, for example, right? So, you know, when you're designing a PCB, you have millions of components to choose from. You can download a footprint that Johnny made a few years ago that you have no idea if this footprint is good or not, right? You can download a footprint from whoever, Easy EDA. You know, the IC design world, like I have maybe 100 different types of transistor. I can change the size and the dimensions of them, but I've only that number of transistors that I can play with, and I know they all work.
Yeah. And those comes from the fab, is that right? Or that's like the design package that comes to the fab?
Exactly. So you have what's called a P-cell or a parameterized cell. So if I want to put down an N-channel MOSFET, for example, I'll take a parameterized cell of an N-channel MOSFET, and that'll let me, you know, change the width and the length of that device. But I can't like change the, you know, the stack up, for example. I can't change the doping or any of that sort of crack. That's, you know, that's relatively fixed at our level.
Oh, interesting.
Right.
Wait, so do some chips actually change the doping, or is it just like
you can I mean, so when TSMC gives you a PDK, the understanding is that firstly, you know, when TSMC gives you a PDK, really it's for the digital guys, and the analog guys, you know, they can play with the transistors too, but this is for the digital guys, right?
So, okay. All right.
Right. So they'll give you a number of flavors of transistor. So you might have a low threshold voltage transistor, a regular threshold voltage transistor, and a high threshold voltage transistor. And what that's really for is for the digital logic to consume, you know, less power and go slower, or more power and go faster. It's to kind of, right. It's to tweak your digital logic. But obviously that has analog, you know, the analog guys can use that to create slightly different effects too, right? You'll be given different flavors of these parameterized cells, and you need to, you know, decide which threshold voltage I want, and then I need to decide how big do I want the transistor, and they're the knobs that you really have.
Got it. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yes. So you know, the vast majority of time.
I'm just thinking about my knowledge is about 15 years out of date now, but what I do remember is that at different stages throughout the semiconductor process, there is a mask layer that's all very, very thick mask layer that also goes towards the implantation steps, and like, you know, different parts of the circuit are going to get different levels of doping and things like that. And so someone's doing that, but it sounds like it's that piece is already set in the PDK, or pretty much set if nothing else. Like you, so you're saying that it's very tough to actually then go and open up part of a mask so that it gets more doping than, you know, like in a wide swath of area, even in analog designs.
Yeah, like, I mean, you can, right, okay, so you can't say, for example, mess with the, I can't point at a particular area and say, I want this level of doping and tweak it like an analog knob. I can't do that. But technically, if I wanted to, I could go into the layout and I can open up an N diffusion or a P, you know, an N well or a P diffusion or something. Or a piece of polysilicon, I can put that all of those things down on the layout. And in certain instances, you do that.
Okay. So that would that be the equivalent of like going in and like modifying Gerber's kind of, is it like at that level of like kind of Wild Westiness on that aspect of it?
Yeah. And I mean, the tools will tell you if it's manufacturable, but, and you know, there are tools that will tell you, for example, if it will cause a latch up or an ESD, you know, or a latch up.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. That's pretty cool.
It is. And that was what I noticed really in terms of going from IC to PCB. Is like, if you do all the DRC checks, and you have to do the DRC checks, it will tell you categorically, this chip is 90% manufacturable, right? We're 90% sure this is manufacturable. And you'll get something back that is what you sent away. And you do the LVS checks, layout versus schematic checks. And you know, you're relatively secure in the knowledge that this thing is what you want. In a PCB, like, it was really scary. Like, you know,
Lower stakes, just to start with, I think. I think that's why the tools aren't quite the same, but yeah, lower stakes.
Yes. Well, I mean, my PCBs were the same price as my chips. So yeah, when you put it that way, it's wild, right? I mean,
the turn time is a lot more stringent.
Yes, for chips, correct.
Right.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the time cost as opposed to the monetary cost. But like, you know, we have a guy who does the PCBs in our, you know, there's a guy, right? You know what I mean? And I remember emailing him being like, hey, you know, could you send me the stack up? You know, what are the dielectric constants? And, you know, I was trying to do some matched impedance traces and stuff. And, you know, what are the minimum tolerances on the, you know, like widths and spacings and stuff? And he goes like, oh yeah, it's a 4-layer stack up. Yeah, take it, you know, 4 point whatever for your dielectric constant, you should be grand. And in my head, I'm going mental. Like, I mean, there's like, I don't know how many thousand DRCs that I just cleared on my chip. And this guy is telling me to take the dielectric constant, you know, four-ish, you know.
Four-ish, yeah. Yeah, that's about right.
Yeah. So that was...
I mean, 10% is usually okay for, you know, matching these stuff, right? Yeah,
pretty standard. Yeah, absolutely. It was the fear factor of like, I could do something in my EDA tool. I could design a PCB and no one is going to tell me that this thing can't be manufactured. I mean, like, I might get an email from the fab saying, what are you doing?
Yeah, right. Ground is connected to the power rail or the power layer. That's bad.
They may not even tell me that. Like, they may tell me, oh, your tracks are too narrow and you may have you may have a yield issue, but they don't necessarily know that my power is connected to ground. And maybe that was intentional.
That's a good point. Yeah, they don't really have that. Yeah, that's true. Sometimes they'll tell you, but not always. Yeah.
Yeah. And like, I'm not sure, I'm not saying it's a deficiency in the PCB design. Like, I've got maybe, you know, 20 components that I can choose from. You've got millions, right? There's no way of testing functionality on a PCB really, unless you've got like a simulation library of every component, you know.
Is that because the CAD software for chips is more integrated from the layout stage, the schematic stage to the layout stage, that is just inherently more connected? Or is it because...
I think so. I think so. Like, I mean, there are, you know, there's the Cadence tool flow, like in terms of what people use and what people pay for, largely there's the Cadence tool flow and there's the Synopsys tool flow. So if you're a foundry and you're tools, your PDK doesn't support Cadence or Synopsys, like nobody's designing you. It's not possible to design that chip.
Duopoly. Yeah,
right. Totally. Exactly. So it's in their best interests to make sure that, you know, they're very, very well integrated. And I think that's changing. And I certainly hope so in terms of, you know, the open source IC design movement.
Oh,
that's really,
it's,
really
it's
exciting.
Maybe it's making a little movement, but I think it's going to be a very small dent for a little while yet. So
yeah, and it's, you know, it's got, you know, there are certain things that will be good at, and it won't be the bleeding edge, but I think it has a place, and I think it should be certainly explored. Like, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, the idea of, you know, of KiCad would probably have been kind of laughed at. Of course you need to pay for your PCB design tools. You know, I don't know. How long has KiCad been going, actually?
Yeah, about 30 years. Yeah, it was like 91, 92. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Okay.
But it was definitely laughed at then at that point, I think.
Right. And I mean, people are taking it seriously now, I think. Same with software. I mean, software, you know, has grown into this open source ecosystem. I know hardware is a lot more difficult, but it would be nice to see, you know, more open source effort.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I think some of it, you know, some of the stuff you've already talked about here with like the Synopsys and Cadence, it's like, I think it's almost vertically, not by design, but like almost by necessity, like the small number of players in the market and the incredible complexity is just like, I honestly don't know how you'd get around it. And I think some of the information would actually be lost. So just thinking about like, I don't ever send my schematic to a board house, right? I just send Gerbers. Right. It's just very generic, very old format. You know, and it's just like, all right, just make this thing. I said how to make it. And so there's really none of that knowledge of, oh, well, this component is connecting these two things together. Okay, fine. They don't care. I don't really care. It's what, you know, low stakes, like I said. But
well,
like,
yeah.
In a chip fab, like, I'm guessing there's a little bit more knowledge of you know, the tying back of the PDK to like what components are actually in there. And
yeah,
like what happens when you send out an analog design to a, you know, a TSMC? Is someone there looking at it, or is it just like, they're like, oh, well, here's the files, we'll put them into our masks.
Right. So before you send it away, they have a like very, very extensive DRC checks. I mean, like, you know, they'll check the layers, they'll check the number of elements in a polygon. It's just stuff like you cannot get away with anything. So
yeah.
So when you're sending
the stakes are so high, it just seems like.
Yeah. And also not only your, so if you're doing this in a multi-project wafer with other people's stuff, right? If your chip is causing an issue, you'll affect the chips around you, right? So a prime example of that is density. So, you know, when you're making a chip, you deposit a metal layer and you polish it. You make the surface plain, and then you add another metal layer. If you have, for example, too much metal or too little metal, more importantly, in your chip, you'll create a little indent when they polish it, right? Yours will polish more than everyone else's. So the DRC checks need to check if you've got a high enough density of metal that the polishing will be even enough, so you don't mess up both your own chip and someone else's.
Do they put in like fake metal structures then if you don't have enough density?
Exactly, yeah. So we have a script that will look at each kind of zone sequentially and kind of fill it in with little polygons of metal here and there. Exactly.
Oh, come on, you don't put in like designs? You don't sign your name in there for the logo?
Oh, no.
Got, like,
of
a
course,
graffiti
right.
tag?
So I'm known in our office for like, no matter what month of the year, like, look, we have one season in Ireland. I always wear shorts for that one season. So year round, I'm always wearing shorts. So, nice. You know, I said, look, there's always going to be at least one short on a chip. So I put like a 10 micron pair of shorts on my chip as one of the dummy metals.
Fantastic. Oh, that's
yeah.
Great.
And I mean, that's also necessary. That, like, it's funny, but you do need some kind of locating factors. Modern chips have so many metal layers and so much of this kind of density fill that actually when someone goes to bond the chip, it's really hard to see what way is up. What's pin one here?
Yeah, totally.
That is one of the requirements, you know, that your practice have, is that you need a logo or you need something, you know, something funny to locate.
Yeah. Orientation element.
Yes.
It may also be a funny logo.
Absolutely. And, you know, I didn't tell my PI, you know, until after I sent in the GDS. Totally. Oh, yeah, by the way, there's a pair of shorts on this chip. Yeah,
yeah, that's great. That's great.
But anyway, so you do all these DRC checks, and then someone in your practice will also run their DRC deck. Now, ideally, your DRC decks are the same, and if you're clean, it'll be clean once it gets to your practice. We all know what happens when DRC decks are sent back and forth in emails and stuff. You get different versions and stuff like this.
Oh, yeah. We talked to Michael about that recently. With
picking
the wrong zip file. Yep.
Exactly. Right. So sometimes you'll have DRC issues kind of that way. But you're relatively certain sending it out that it's manufacturable and it won't mess up other people's stuff. Yeah. Now, and the fab, I should also say, like, the fab doesn't care what you're doing. They don't see your schematic. They just care that it's...
Okay. So it is similar in that way.
It is similar in that way. We have quite extensive LVS, layout versus schematic. And this is, you know, as soon as you turn on your... So you do your layout, your chip is looking well. You run your DRCs, your DRC clean, happy days, right? You turn on layout versus schematic, and it basically checks that the transistors that you've drawn in the layout, and a transistor is defined by a gate and, you know, two diffusions either side of it, right? So that's what a transistor is, and the LVS will pick up if it sees a gate and a diffusion either side of it. That's a transistor, right? So obviously the number of transistors in your schematic must equal the number in your layout, and here is the kicker, right? A transistor is a four terminal device. You learn that as soon as you turn on the LVS, right? For the majority of your design.
Body diode.
Yeah, exactly, right? So the majority of your design, I'll just tie the bulk to ground, da-da-da. But you forget that, you know, the chip is a whole block of silicon. And unless you do something fancy, all those bulks are tied together. And if you've got different power domains, for example, they'll show up as a what's called a soft connect, a connect through the bulk silicon. And that will fail your LVS because you could have latch up, for example, through different power domains, you know?
You know, and they teach like the four terminal device thing in school, but boy, that didn't make any sense to me, you know? And it's just like, I don't know. It feels like one of those mental models where they should be like, okay, it's four. We're going to talk about three, you know? Like,
yeah.
And I know that's what eventually happens anyways, but like until you get to the level that you're talking about and actually designing a chip, like it's so hard to visualize. It's still hard to visualize, honestly. And it's just, it's
yeah.
Crazy.
And you know, I think teaching transistors and the idea of, you know, it being a, you know, a valve that you turn on and off, and depending on how much you turn the gate on or off, you vary the current. I think that's what people need to know. And then when you need to design a chip, fine, learn about the bulk. But, you know, it's okay not to know about it until you need to know about it, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there are effects, but it's just like, I don't know, it's just so it's like you have to kind of like really tunnel vision down just to get the stuff that's actually really tough in the first place. And then like, yeah, okay, you're going to zoom out at some point and take those blinders off and be like, oh, crap, there's a lot more to learn. But that's also the fun part, right? I mean, like, yeah.
Exactly. You know, an engineering course is, you know, a finite amount of time and you can only learn so much, you know, certain things you need to cut out and certain things you don't need to know. Yeah. And, you know, you inspire people to learn these things themselves at a later date. But yeah.
Yeah. So one thing I always wonder about with this sort of thing is how much, so you mentioned like you kind of have this 100 transistors you can pick from. But then are you constructing your own like elements that then you kind of bundle together more? So like do you have your own current source that you might drop at multiple places throughout the design?
Yeah.
And that's like a component, quote unquote?
Absolutely. So chip design is very hierarchical. So when you boot up Cadence, what do you see? You see your work divided in three columns, right? It's similar. I must admit, right? I'm intending to transition to KiCad, but I haven't yet. In Eagle, you've got libraries.
No confessions are required on this programming thing. It's okay. I forgive you, my son.
I'm trying to open sourceify my life. So KiCad is next on the list, right?
It's going to take a while within the chip industry, I think. So.
So anyway, right? You open up Cadence, right? You have a library of components. You have a cell, and you have got what are called cell views. Right. So your library might be, I might have like, for example, a library of op amps, a library of different ring oscillator delay cells. I might have different bias, a library full of different bias circuits, stuff like this. Right. Mm. And then cell views will be the particulars. And then, you know, cells will be the particular, you know, a 10 microamp bias circuit or a 20 microamp bias circuit. And then the cell views will be whether it's a schematic or a layout. Right. And when I have a top level of a chip, it's effectively like a set of Russian dolls made up of these different components kind of layered on top of each other. So it's incredibly hierarchical. You may have, you know, dozens of layers. You know, I may have a cell that's 20 transistors big, and I may put that around different places and have it on multiple hierarchies and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's very building blocks oriented, so you can reuse things, hopefully.
Got it, yeah. Well, and so, I mean, so in our conversation before the show too, like, so this is a mixed signal IC. So there's also, it's not just analog, right? So it's also got other stuff in there. So part of what I was working towards is like, is there that everything else that has to tie into it? So like all the control circuitry, things like that, like, is that something that you get to just be like, knock on your neighbor's cube and be like, hey, can I use your digital control circuit to turn on this other aspect? Or how does that work?
Ideally, yes. In my case, no. And you know, it's a pain when you're taping out, but afterwards it's great because you kind of gain a kind of a glancing understanding of what everything does. So
yeah, right.
Yeah, we have a digital person in our group, and she's really, really helpful in terms of doing the digital stuff. But she kind of says like, look, you know, figure it out. When you get errors, come to me, kind of a thing. It's very, you know, it's Verilog. The digital is written in Verilog, right? So let me
got it. Okay.
So let me put context on it, right? I've got a ring oscillator and it's giving me bits out at 1 gig sample per second. Now, there's not a hope in hell I'm going to be able to get that off my chip easily, right? The pads are far too slow. The bond wires have inductance that would stop me getting that off too easily, right? So I needed to downsample the output of my ring oscillator. So you can use what's called a sink filter or a decimation filter to do that. And effectively what that does is it filters the data first, and then it downsamples it to, you know, you might, instead of having one bit at 1 gig sample per second, you might have 8 bits at 32 meg samples per second, for example, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. So you program that in Verilog, and you have an ideal Verilog test bench, like you would just simulate any Verilog, you know, whether it be for FPGA or whatever else, and then you synthesize it. And what synthesis means is it fits your Verilog, and I mean, it's the same with an FPGA, to available blocks. But the available blocks are what are known as standard cells. So you might have an AND, you know, a 4-element AND, a 2-element AND, you might have flip-flop, different flip-flops. So you synthesize the Verilog, which creates a gate-level Verilog, and then you then do place and route. So you actually place the cells in the chip and wire it, and, you know, it has to meet timing. So the tools can handle all of the actual putting the digital on the chip. You just write the Verilog. And I apologize to any digital designers. I know it's a lot more complicated than that. But for my simple case, that's how it works.
So then all that stuff's done. And then now you basically have kind of the equivalent gate level. It's just using the standard transistors like you mentioned, right? So now it's like this, what I'm really imagining in my mind is like, you've got this pastoral, nice, well laid out farmland. And then you're basically like, there's like a hard, like county line, and then you're like going into like a downtown, and there's just like a cityscape of like digital mess that you're basically going into the Lincoln Tunnel, and like, you know, like all of the data is going through there or something.
Yeah, you know, I'll send you a picture of the chip. Like, I mean, there's like, you know, my little analog section. I spent all my time like, you know, perfecting and tweaking my little analog section, and then there's just this big behemoth of digital that I made like in a panic at the last minute, and it's just ugly, and it's right in the middle of the chip, right? It's funny to look at, but you have to be careful. You know, there's a finite, you can get a finite amount of current through the power supplies in your chip. So if your digital takes a big gulp of current, you need to be careful that doesn't take away from the available supply on the analog side. So you'll there's like a slit right down the middle of my chip. So the ring of pads is split right in the middle. And the right-hand side is all the digital stuff, and that's dirty. And on the left-hand side is the analog stuff, and hopefully that's quiet.
And how do you actually separate those domains? Because you don't get to say, oh, actually, no, this is a different wafer. Same wafer.
Yeah. Right. So, and I mean, the point I made earlier about, you know, the bulk, you get a piece of silicon, the bulks are connected. You can do different tricks. So you can do what's called a deep N-well, which effectively is a buried. So your silicon wafer is lightly P-type. But what you can do is you can, you know, blast layers in, and you can have a buried layer of N-type. So you have a kind of a PNP sort of stack vertically, and you can kind of stitch around that. So you make a tub, like a bathtub. It's kind of isolated because you've got reverse bias PN junctions. So you can put your sensitive analog stuff in this deep N-well, and therefore it's technically, you know, it's on the same chip, but it's technically at least electrically isolated or capacitively isolated from the digital stuff. And the digital stuff just sits in the tub or sits in the main substrate. The digital stuff just doesn't care, right? And you have, you know, you have separate power domains. You make sure that you have a digital supply, and then you have a clean analog supply on the chip and stuff like that too.
So on the deep N-well thing, so is that like the early in the I'm just, again, thinking back to my limited early semiconductor days. And like, I remember there'd be like some early stages where they're just like doing high energy, like you go to send something to implant with like these huge open windows where the mask is really open, and they're just like cranking the thing all the way up and just trying to shove some kind of dopant as deep as they can into the wafer. Is that like the deep N-well type of thing?
Yeah, that I unfortunately would love to get to make this myself. I don't, and you know, TSMC certainly aren't going to tell me how they do it. But again, you know, if they want to, they're more than welcome to, but they're not going to tell me how it's done.
They're a little close to the vest on stuff. Yeah.
Right. I know, for example, like making, if you want to make a good drain, you know, it's difficult to make a good like drain and source. So I know you really need to beat the dopants in there. Again, you know, I'm not a device guy. I don't know. But yeah, it's that idea. I can't remember how they do the deep Enwell, the buried layer. It's some weird ion implantation thing anyway. Yeah.
Yeah, because I remember some of the stuff they actually like wind up. They have like a cyclotron effectively, and they just wind it all up and then they shoot it out the back end of this cannon, and it shoots dopants. It's insane how it works, but it like shoots dopants into wafers. Okay, cool. And then sometimes they actually bake it in with like a
right.
an oven, right?
That's yeah, you have to repair the damage done by that blast. Yeah. And right. I know you can do right. funny things with the energy, like if you have a certain energy, you know it'll go a certain depth, you know.
That's right.
The,
yeah.
Right, yeah.
Kilo electron volts, mega electron volts, all that stuff. It's like, yeah, they talk about that sort of thing.
Yeah, you know, it's the real engineering
it's crazy.
Behind
it. It's crazy yeah. how it works. I mean, like, yeah, it's just like, that's how we're talking right now across vast distances, right?
Yeah, it's crazy that it works. Yeah, exactly, you know, yeah.
It's done on a very large scale.
Yeah, like, yeah, 100 years ago, you were 2 weeks away. You're now 70 milliseconds away because of this sort of
yeah,
stuff.
That's right.
It's incredible, right? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, okay, so you got this chip working. You're hopefully on your path towards being... Doctor, what's next? I mean, jumping to the chip company that sponsored you, is that the path that you mentioned is your path, or
yeah, I mean that's something I'm trying to figure out at the moment. Like it's, you know, the problem with this, right? So firstly, we talked before the show about, you know, what you know, people who want to maybe think about going down the same route as me or a similar route. One piece of advice that one of my co-supervisors gave me before I signed the piece of paper was, look, a PhD is like a religion, right? It means nothing to anyone else apart from you, right? They don't care that you're doing one, right? They think, yeah, oh, cool. Yeah. You know, you get a new funny name. No one cares, right?
That's right.
You're not entitled to any more money or any more respect. You do it because you believe in it. And whether you choose it, it's then a tool in your toolbox. Whether you choose to use it or not is, again, you know, it's up to you. You know, that was kind of profound. And that's kind of the juncture I'm at right now. Like, I mean, I want to stay technical. I couldn't be doing all of this Outlook all day sort of crack. But, you know, so you know, the managerial route isn't probably where I'd like to go. My options are, you know, go into the company that sponsors me, and you know, I do interesting work. Like, I mean, I'm a designer, but the trade-off is, you know, you have security, but you're a small part, you're a small cog in the chain effectively, and you're doing a small part of a much bigger operation. Yeah, do you go into something
right? Are you doing just current starved ring oscillators for the rest of your career? Well, that might not be as rewarding as something else, but
exactly,
you might get really deep and find some really interesting things in there and become a world expert, right?
Sure, yeah. And I mean, there's benefits to being, you know, the guy in the company, you know, and you grow out your beard and you're, right? right. You know, you're
you mean I can't wear sandals to work with socks on? I'm the guy.
Yeah, yeah,
you can't tell exactly. me not to do that. I'm the guy.
Yeah. Ideally, you know, what would I love? I look at the software people with envy sometimes. You know, if you have a computer and you have the ability for a few months not to get paid, there's a chance you might stumble across, like, you know, a good software startup, right? It is tougher in the chip world. What would it take for me to do a silicon startup? Well, obviously, first, a good idea, but then you have the logistical stuff. How do I get CAD tools? How do I get TSMC to give me a copy of their PDK? How do I get the money for my first prototype run? It's tougher, but you know, again, look, if anyone wants ring oscillators, I'll gladly gladly set up a startup and we can do business, right?
I mean, that's the thing too. I think that the existing stuff you've been working on, the stuff that you are, I mean, I said world expert before, but like, you know, PhDs are supposed to be that world expert in that very narrow PhD way that PhDs are, right? But there's a lot of stuff you need to put around it as well, right? And so there's just other business aspects, other chip stuff, you know, how much do people need just that one thing? And so,
yeah, then, exactly. Yeah. There's a lot more to it than just what one person can provide to make a chip. You know, we love playing with things, but you need the people to do the marketing and you need the people to do the finances and all of that sort of stuff. You know, it's very difficult. like to go from I have a cool idea of how to make a ring oscillator better to actually here are my chips on DigiKey. That's a long road, and that's not a one person road either, you know?
No, that's right. Yeah, I think that's right. I think, you have to have either like a non-technical co-founder that you trust implicitly to, you know, run the business side. And like, if you want to stay technical, and I think the benefit of these days with startups, especially in the chip space, is like one, I mean, well, we've seen in the news that every single chip company gets gobbled up these days. And I'm sure that's not a trend that's going away anytime soon.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I think access to fabs is more than it was, right? So like fabless semiconductor startups are a thing now, maybe not a common thing, but they are possible.
Oh, certainly.
So that's good too. Yeah. I think you could make a case for even adding on RISC-V style processors along, you know, your digital section might be a not needing to talk to ARM for their licensing and things like that. So I think in all these ways, there's a lot of benefit there. But then are you targeting the right niche? Are you, you know, like, does the world need that current measurement device that you're talking about, whatever? So yeah, it's just,
and then
dealing with all the funding stuff is just a lot of.
Yeah, like the tooling is coming, right? We were talking about the open source tooling. That's coming. I think the fabs are starting to sense what direction the wind is blowing. You know, you've got the SkyWater fab with their open source PDK. And, you know, the funding is there. Like, you know, I'm lucky enough to be in a research environment. And if I put a proposal together, I could do a postdoc and kind of work on a startup. Like it's possible. And it's becoming more possible at the moment.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. There's options.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I think the only thing that's more glamorous than the life of a PhD student is the life of a postdoc.
Oh, yeah. Like, that's great. Like, you know, you get paid nothing for your postdoc. Right. And you don't even get a fancy new name. Like, you know.
Who's that broken person over there? Oh, well, they're the postdoc.
Yeah, you can just
Sorry,
ask
any postdocs who are listening. I don't mean to, you know.
No, like I would love to be a postdoc, right? I would just love to get paid for the privilege of doing so.
Ideal,
you know, if you could get paid like you'd get paid in a company and get to sit and like solve people's problems, like have PhD students come to you and just work through problems with them, like come on, that's a dream,
that
right?
That's cool. Yeah, totally. I think it's called consulting. You know, you should just become a consultant. You know?
If anyone needs ring oscillators or is trying to figure out how they work. Chris, I'll be on the forum right after this, you know.
Okay, great. Bring it on.
Yeah, but I mean, the tool chain is getting better for the one other thing I wanted to kind of briefly mention was, you know, we've had a lot of change recently and the way we learn, for example, circuits is changing and has changed. Yeah. Like, right, I'm teaching half a course on nonlinear circuits this year. And the change that has occurred so I took that course in 2016. And the change that has occurred in those short few years is great, right? So back then, and it was the same for you, I'm sure, right? You go into your circuits class and you blast equations, you write frantically for an hour, and you have equations, you know, you have the lecturers who make you take everything down, right? You go out and your mind is frazzled and you have taken very little in. Now, the pandemic has enabled us to say, right, you know, okay, first of all, maybe our lectures will be in person, or maybe things will change again and they will not be in person. So we need to have the facility to ensure that we can teach our students either way. So what's kind of happened is, you know, we give out the notes, first of all, so students don't have to frantically take things down. And furthermore, they don't have to, you know, they can pause a lecture. The idea that a lecture is recorded and they can pause it, I think is a, you know, big change. Absolutely. So you can.
Yeah, I mean, like, visceral feeling of just like I remember this, like sitting in the auditorium or wherever the class was. Bigger classes were usually more stressful for me, but like sitting in the auditorium, looking around and everyone else is just nodding their head. And I'm just like, wait, what the hell did he just say? Like, is nobody going to stop nodding their head for a second? And then like also like I don't want to raise my hand. I don't want to stop people, like, whatever, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just, and it just keeps rolling, you know?
I mean, if you stop to think about it for a second, you've lost, right? You don't have that equation taken down. So it's now not in your notes. Whereas now, like, it's great. We are able to say, right, here are all your notes. Don't worry about taking it down. Sit back, right? look, yeah. Put your phone away.
Just put the brain part in motion, right?
Exactly, right? And what we do now is, you know, we'll go through the slides and then we'll take a second and we'll open up, I don't know if you're familiar with Falstad, the circuit simulator.
Oh, I love Falstad. Yeah. Oh, yes. Right? Awesome.
Yeah, exactly. And you could say like, look, right, look, I've given you all the equations for a BJT, a bipolar transistor, right? Look, fine, right? Go back and study them for the exam. Look, if I put a little bit of current into the base, a load of current is going to come out of the emitter, right? Yeah, you know, killer. And the visualization piece of that
is super important too, because it's, you need to, you're literally connecting the dots, literally watching someone connect the dots in that case, right? Where, as you're doing that, because the dots are flowing, you're like, oh, okay, visualizing current. Yeah, whatever. That is super important.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is this just the way you teach it, or is everybody doing this? Because I could see it also just being, you know, some people just doing the de facto and blasting through stuff.
There's a kind of a debate right now. And I know different people on different sides of this argument about, like, you know, should you teach the... So you're allotted 2 hours per week to teach your subject. Should you teach the subject in those 2 hours, or should you give the material to the students beforehand in video lectures and then have like a tutorial for those 2 hours, right? Mm-hmm. I'm firmly in the have the tutorial for the 2 hours camp.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I think we do something quite practical. I think a good number of academics are going that way. And I think power to them, you know, absolutely. The other people kind of say, well, you know, maybe the students won't look at the video lectures, or can we implicitly trust them? And, you know, I say, look, college is expensive. We motivate
the service industry.
Yeah, I believe that, you know, people go to college hopefully to learn, to have fun too, but hopefully to learn, you know, let's trust students and give them the tools and see if they come.
Yeah, it's going to bite them in the ass at some point if they don't, you know, if you don't actually learn it, there's no getting around it, sitting in your cube at Intel or wherever you end up, you know.
In Ireland, we have fairly grueling exams. So, I mean, look, you have a gate that if you don't keep up, there is a gate that you can't get through. So, you know, it's in your best interests to keep up, right? But I think, we've had too many generations of people who understand the equations behind the circuits that we do, or, you know the equations, but don't like, that were never given the intuitive grasp of like, oh, in your head, if you can twist a knob to see how, you know, mm-hmm. how this changes the parameter in the circuit or whatever, you know. I think at this point,
I'm guessing people are going to start having Falstad style schematics and little dots in their head, you know. I internalize tools like that all the time,
right? Yeah, me too, right? I mean, yeah, I think, and I, you know, real-time simulations like that, you know, bring them into the fancy IC design tools, like, you know, Cadence isn't too fancy for that. I want to see the little dots in Cadence too, because
that is really good to hear, even if it's not everybody doing it. If there's some motion in that way, that is definitely a silver lining of the shakeup that is the past 2.5 years.
I think that's
obviously many downsides of the past 2.5 years, but yeah.
Yeah, no, let's be positive. There were some good aspects, I suppose. Yeah.
Well, Anthony, as you figure things out and decide where to go, we'd love to hear from you again and see what you're building next, because it sounds like you're going to be building some cool things in silicon and in the world. So thanks for joining us here today.
And thanks very much for having me, Chris. It's been an absolute honor.
All right, we'll chat soon.
Thank you.